Look around. What do you see? Cars. Lots of them. And guess what? They're probably on Auto Trader. Whether you're into timeless classics or the latest trends, did somebody say solar-powered, eco-friendly, vegan, leather-wrapped, aromatherapy-scented, disco ball-equipped, self-driving car? If you see it on the road, you can likely find it on Auto Trader. Big cars, small cars, blue cars, new cars, used cars, electric cars, and one day, maybe even flying cars. With millions of options to choose from, buying a car becomes a whole lot easier. See it, find it, Auto Trader.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. With me, as always, is Charles W. Chuck Bryant, which makes this Stuff You Should Know.
Heck no, we won't go.
That's different.
Heck no, we won't record.
That's more along the lines of what we're talking about.
Better pay for podcasters.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, we could get together with like Adam Curry and Joe Rogan and
Mark Maron.
Maybe even Ira.
Mm-hmm.
And form like some sort of local.
He would be our Jimmy Hoffa.
Yeah.
Ira would be.
Is that a threat?
No.
Are you threatening Ira Glass?
No, he would be our Jimmy Hoffa. He would make things happen.
James P. Hoffa? The one that the current Teamsters president?
Either one. I'm not saying get rid of him, bury him in Giant Stadium. I'm saying Ira would make it happen. He would break legs.
Oh, okay.
If need be.
Well, he's well known for that kind of thing. He's a leg-breaking goon. So for those of you who've already seen the title of this, you understand the banter, I guess.
Sure.
If you have no idea what we're talking about, I'll bet you guessed by now that we're talking about labor unions today. Yeah?
It's a good one, man. We had this requested a lot last year from Scotty's.
Right.
When the whole Wisconsin Scott Walker thing was going
on. I know, and we're just now getting to it because the Scott Walker thing is like my intro.
Well, let's hear it.
So you remember last year in Wisconsin, Chuck?
Yes.
There was this big hubbub that was going on. And a lot of people were wondering if this is going to be like the beginning of the Arab Spring in the United States.
Yeah.
This was going to be the flashpoint for it because Governor Scott Walker was accused of trying to de-unionize the public sector employees, state employees.
Yeah.
Through a little bit of legislation that he was trying to introduce.
That is very true, and it caused quite a stir, like thousands of protesters.
Yeah, there was some serious protests going on.
Mm-hmm.
And at the heart of this whole thing was some legislation where he was trying to get the public sector employees' unions to get their union members, i.e., the public sector employees.
Yes.
I.e. means that is, e.g. Yes. is for example.
I realize that.
To basically pay in half of their pensions.
Yeah.
Give up some other concessions, like if they were going to get a raise, it had to be through public referendum.
Yeah, anything over a rate of inflation, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But probably the biggest one was that they were stripped of their ability to collectively bargain.
Yeah, that was the big one.
And it worked. It got pushed through. And now if you are a state employee union member in Wisconsin, you can't collectively bargain anymore, which means you are effectively neutered as a union member in a lot of ways.
True.
That is one of the hallmarks of the unions. And depending on where you come from, what you believe, who raised you, whether or not your grandpa was still alive when you were old enough to understand what he was talking about,
mm-hmm.
That I think that largely depends on how you feel about unions. A lot of people think they're a good thing.
Yeah.
A lot of people think they're bad. A lot of people think they're necessary. A lot of people think they're evil. A lot of people think they're a necessary evil. And in fact, they're kind of, America as it stands is kind of split down the middle. these days. A Pew poll that was taken during this whole hubbub in Wisconsin showed that 45% of Americans had a positive view of organized labor.
Okay.
Which I found surprising.
You thought that was high?
Yeah, yeah. I was surprised because the decline of union has also been attended by a change in perception toward them, you know, like
yeah.
they're kind of bad or that they hamstring business is another big one. But they also found that 51% still believe unions are needed to improve working people's lives.
Right.
So necessary evil. I nailed it.
You did. And unsurprisingly, a lot of times your feelings on unions are drawn along political lines these days.
Yeah. They're often accused of being like the an organizing backbone for the Democratic Party.
Sure.
But that's not always true. Like, very frequently, unions throw their weight and their support behind Republicans as well.
Sure.
At any rate, let's get to the bottom of what all this is. Are unions good? We're probably going to avoid this kind of qualitative descriptor and instead just kind of stick to the facts and let the people decide. Power to the people to decide whether unions are good or not.
I think that's a good move, Josh.
Thank you.
So we got stats. We'll get to those later. Unions, Josh. Industrial Revolution is kind of where, actually, we go back further, which we will, with medieval times?
Yeah, the trade guilds.
Trade guilds sort of were the beginnings, seeds of unions, and they originally sort of came about, though, just to swap techniques and recipes, and then that sort of evolved a bit into, hey, why don't we get together and also share, aside from our knowledge, get together and maybe share expertise on how to do things better and get better wages, maybe.
Or fix prices, that's one.
Yeah.
Before they figured out that was immoral.
And this is medieval Europe, long time ago.
Yeah. And the trade guilds were definitely the origin of unions. It's just a bunch of workers getting together and figuring out, because this is essentially what a union is, mm-hmm. that they have more strength in numbers.
Exactly.
And it's also an indication of workers understanding their value in the production process.
Sure.
That what they're essentially doing in return for their salary was producing a profit for a business.
Yeah.
So you have labor and business, right? Mm-hmm. And that gives them a certain sense of value, whereas in a lot of situations, workers feel like, you know, they're very grateful for their job and they don't want to make any waves or anything like
right.
that. And they're not fully aware of their value. And
sure.
I think unions, one of the roles that unions play is to point out to a worker, hey, you're doing something in return. This isn't some sort of welfare situation that you're involved
right.
in. You're producing labor, and that has value.
Yeah, and certain rights as well.
Exactly.
All right, so flash forward a bit to the Industrial Revolution, 19th century. Things moved away a little bit from agriculture and agricultural jobs. Moved into the factories, as we all know. And kind of right off the bat, factories weren't a good scene for fair wages and safe conditions and kids working in factories and women and children not being paid as much as men.
Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, that was a big turning point.
What was?
The Triangle Shirtwaist Company fire, where the working conditions were really, really dangerous. It was a clothing company, clothing uh-huh. manufacturer, I think in Chicago or New York. I can't remember. And it caught fire. The factory did because there was all this fabric in the air.
Right.
And it just ignited and the whole place went up and all of these women had to jump to their deaths.
Good Lord.
And that kind of brought working conditions into the limelight.
Well,
and help
there you
union
have it.
Sentiment, I guess.
A flashpoint, if you will.
Exactly.
From your favorite, Mr. Gladwell. Didn't he flashpoint?
Tipping point.
Oh, tipping point. Good Lord. Get it together, Chuck. Okay. I've got it together now.
Okay.
Tipping point.
Yeah.
I had to take a little break. In the 19th century, they would do things called striking.
Yeah.
Which they still do today, but back then it was a more contentious and violent affair than it is today.
Yeah.
Like, people died, bombs went off, guns were shot.
Yeah, there was, and it was on both sides too. I mean, like the workers were striking. The point was the whole was the same.
Yeah.
Where we're not working anymore, and you're not going to make any money because we're not producing the product that you need to go sell.
Right.
Right. But during these times, like the National Guard would show up, or the cops would show up, or maybe the Pinkerton Detective Agency would show up,
yeah,
and just start beating the tar out of the striking workers in order to scare them back into working. Workers also would defend themselves. There was this one, I can't remember what strike it was, I just read about it, where like the workers managed to like chase the cops off.
Really?
Because they were shooting 2-pound hinges in these oversized slingshots, like at the cops. And
really?
I can imagine getting hit by a 2-pound hinge.
So it was a hinge factory?
It had to have been.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, so the strikes were very violent. People, like you said, would die.
And the cops were like, why couldn't the cotton ball factory have been on the strike? but not funny, though, because people did die. Not making light of it. Like the Haymarket riot, for instance.
Yeah.
For instance?
That was a big one.
For instance.
That was a turning point, a flashpoint, if you will.
It was. Early May 1886, there was a nationwide strike saying we only want to work 8 hours a day. And in Chicago's Haymarket, there was a violent protest. Not a lot of people were there because the weather, thank goodness, because someone threw a bomb into the crowd.
Yeah.
And it went off. And shots were fired by the cops, maybe by the protesters. And
probably
apparently
both.
They were not just striking laborers, but there were anarchists there. And, you know, those anarchists.
Yeah.
They're trouble.
Well, this is one of the places where, in the public imagination at least, that anarchists and socialists became married to labor, like pro-labor.
Yeah.
And it's always kind of haunted labor unions.
Sure.
Is that idea. But it was born out of this era, if not this riot.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
In the end, 8 people were charged and convicted. The labor leaders tried to get them out, saying this is not fair. One of the people committed suicide by placing a stick of dynamite in his mouth in prison.
Yeah.
Whew.
Yeah.
And in the end, a few years later, the governor of Illinois granted a full pardon to the remaining 3 convicted. And that ended up leading to an observance of May Day or Labor Day in other countries.
Right. May 1st is supposed to be Labor Day. This whole affair, though, you left out that 4 of the guys who were convicted were hanged.
Oh, well, yeah.
And then one guy committed suicide, and then 3 were...
right.
But they were charged with, like, basically agitating violence. This was back when free speech wasn't protected quite as much as it is now.
Right.
But they were pardoned, and as a result, this whole May Day thing, this Labor Day thing, came up in May 1st. But then, within like 5 years, Grover Cleveland was like, "Well, this is kind of a sordid, like, scary association with labor. Let's just celebrate labor, and I'm going to move it to the first Saturday. No, the first
Monday
in September.
If it was Saturday, it'd be no good because we wouldn't get off work.
Exactly.
Did he move it to disassociate from that? Oh, interesting.
Specifically.
So that's why you can't wear white after September. September.
Exactly. That's exactly the origin of that.
All right. So maybe let's talk about some of the basics of a labor union, Josh. There's many different kinds. And like you said, it's all about strength in numbers to get together to form what's called a bargaining unit with an elected leader to deal with the employer.
Right. Because, I mean, think about it. If you have somebody who's advocating for your success, for your rights,
mm-hmm.
higher wages, better conditions, whatever it might be, you are removing yourself to a certain extent from that negotiation.
Yeah.
So it's a little less sticky for you.
Sure.
Because you're not talking to your employer. You're not saying, I really want some more money.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else is going, these guys are making a bunch of money for you and you need to share it a little better.
Like an agent.
Exactly, right.
In a way.
And at the same time, you also have that element of that bargaining unit being a collective bargaining unit, meaning there's that strength in numbers. So it's a bunch of people becoming satisfied at the same time. And implied in there is if you don't do this, then you're going to lose a bunch of people all at once and you're going to have some trouble.
Right. And they do this agreement in the form of the CBA, or Collective Bargaining Agreement. Right. Any fan of any professional sports will understand what a CBA is and how tenuous they can be.
Yeah.
Once you have negotiated this agreement and everyone on the employer side says, you know, we can live with these terms, and everyone on the employee side said, yeah, we can live with this. We both give a little bit. They sign it, and it is set for a certain period of time, and you cannot break the CBA on either side without there being legal action or grievances filed, which usually means an arbitrator will come in and say, you know, let me get involved.
Right. You, I feel like, just hit the nail on the head, though, for an ideal union presence in business.
Everyone give a little?
Yeah. You know, you can't have too much on one side or the other, but I think that that's kind of the history of the presence of unions in business in America. It's been, if you look over time, it's maybe evened out, but if you look at in any specific decade, it's more on one side than the other.
Of as far as who's in the beneficial position?
Right. Yeah. Or who's asking more, who's extracting more.
Yeah.
Like Samuel Gompers, who got together the American Federation of Labor, I think.
Yeah.
When he was asked what the AFL wanted, his answer was more.
Yeah.
And
very
I mean,
famous quote.
Yeah. But at the same time, you have to say, well, business isn't going to just say, just give it away. Very
sure.
Rarely do they. The whole presence of unions is to extract that. At least that was the original idea of them.
Yeah.
You know?
Unions, like any organization, cost a little money to run. So you have to pay dues. It's a membership thing.
Right.
If I was in the Screen Actors Guild, which I'm not, I would pay dues to the Screen Actors Guild every year to keep my membership current. And then they would go fight for me, and they would have a staff that gets paid out of that money.
Right.
I love in here that it says dues vary, but many are around $50 a month.
What a deal.
Yeah, I think it completely varies depending on what union you're in.
Sure.
I don't know that you can put an average number, or maybe you can if you average it.
Well, if you counted them all up and divided
them. Yeah,
but
I don't think that's what they did here.
No, it was $50 a month.
Yeah.
Act now. They're also supposed to be democracies with elected
True.
Officials, elected leaders who take action based on referendums and votes, and basically just using voting to take the pulse of the union members to see what they want to do.
Ideally, that's how it works.
Yeah.
I get the feeling it didn't always work that way throughout history.
Yeah, especially once the mob got involved.
Yes, which we'll get to. A lot of times you can be a local union member, which is sort of like being a fraternity member of a larger national charter, and if you're a local union, that means that you maybe work in that same business sector, but you're employed by a different company. But it's like, hey, I'm in the, and I keep going back to film business stuff because they were lousy with unions, still are. Like, hey, I work in the art department. I'm a props guy, so I'm a member of the local, I can't remember the number, union here in Atlanta, but it's a national charter, probably based
right.
out of LA, if
yeah.
I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. It's like a chapter of a fraternity or a sorority.
Yeah, which is what I said.
Yeah. Did you say fraternity or sorority?
Yeah.
No, you didn't.
I said fraternity.
Wow. You didn't. You didn't add sorority?
No, no. Good point. Sororities as well.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Chuck, what's the point of all this? I think we've kind of touched on a little bit of it, like especially in the strength in numbers thing, but there's other benefits to being in a union, correct?
Yeah. Should we throw out some stats here?
I think this is high time for stats.
Your wages, for one, your median weekly income is going to be, as a union member, about $940. It's going to be about $730 if you're non-union. Let me see here. You've got some about healthcare, correct?
Yeah. So 88% of union workers, and this is from the Department of Labor. This isn't like from the AFL-CIO or anything.
Right.
88% of union workers have health coverage. 69% of non-union workers do.
Yeah.
It's the same with dental plans. The disparity is even more. 44% of non-union workers have dental plans, where something like 66% have a dental plan if you're a member of a union. Half of union jobs have vision coverage, and only about a quarter of non-union jobs have it. Which, in reading this also, I was kind of like, man, we have pretty good benefits here at Discovery.
Yeah, we do.
You know?
If you're a minority, if you're a woman, African-American or Latino, you're going to make more money. Women earn about $9,000 more a year if you're in a union. African Americans, $8,000 more a year. And Latinos, close to $12,000 more a year if you're a union member.
Yeah.
So aside from safe working conditions and health insurance and things like that, which are great, wages are really the big deal.
Right. Wages, benefits, pensions are another huge one as well.
Pensions, sure.
And they're also there to protect workers from being unjustly fired. So, we're non-union, and somebody could come in here and say, you know what? I didn't like the way that you looked at your boss. I saw you scowling. You're fired. You're fired. You're fired. You're fired. And we'd be like, you can't do that. And they'd be like, oh, yes, we can. And that would be that.
Yeah.
Right? There was like a big hubbub in Florida about some workers that all wore orange, either depending on who you ask, because they were all going to happy hour together that night, or because they were simulating prisoner garb to protest the working conditions at this law firm.
Which is really what they were doing.
And like, 12 of them were fired. They were just taken into a conference room, and the guy was like, you're all fired, and that's that. And they're like, you can't fire us for wearing an orange shirt. And actually, yes, very much so. Since it's a right-to-work state, or an at-will work state.
Yeah, right-to-work.
The employer very much can fire you for wearing something as seemingly arbitrary as wearing orange.
Interesting.
If you're a union member, that is not the case. The union protects you from unjust dismissal.
Right.
And basically, if you feel like you've been fired for wearing orange, you can go to your union rep and a big stink comes about.
Right.
So that's another big one, is protecting them. But I also feel like here is a good point to mention a lot of the criticisms of unions.
Okay.
Because that same protection from unjust dismissal, unions are frequently criticized for that extending to workers who perform poorly.
Sure.
If, like, it's part of that give, I think, with unions among labor to say, okay, yes, we're going to protect you, but you have to be productive or you have to be good at your job or whatever.
Right. Don't hide under the shield of the union just to go phone in your job every day and collect your paycheck.
Exactly. And, you know, flaunt that protection. That's not what it's there for. Another big criticism is that union, just the presence of unions in any country, harms economic progress on the whole by hamstringing business and making it less competitive among countries that don't have unions.
Right.
And so for states that have state employee unions, a big one is that state employee pensions can be a drain on tight state economies.
Right.
That's another big one, too. So there's criticisms of unions that are very legitimate,
sure,
too. But, again, I think it comes down to, like, where your political affiliation is.
Well, yeah. I mean, these days, Republicans are more likely to not be in favor of unions, and they have consistently been called the backbone of the Democratic Party. That wasn't always the case, though. In the 1950s, Republican President Dwight Eisenhower said that unions have a secure place in our industrial life. Only a handful of reactionaries harbor the ugly thought of breaking unions and depriving working men and women of the right to join the union of their choice.
Yeah.
And also throughout history, unions have kind of dabbled outside their own labor negotiations and protection to fight for things like Medicare, Social Security.
Civil rights.
Civil rights is a big one. I think Missouri Congressman Richard Bolling said, quote, "We would have never passed the Civil Rights Act without labor. They had the muscle. The other civil rights groups did not."
Yeah.
So they're, you know, you don't want to see anyone strong arm, but there is certainly something to be said for strength in numbers, especially when it comes to something like the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah. Who was it, Eisenhower, who had that quote about union rights? Eisenhower speaking at a time that was just after the peak of union membership. In 1945, 35% of all non-agricultural workers, which is like everybody but farmers, belonged to unions. Now it's down to 11.8%.
Yeah, and the public sector, 37%, but where they're really getting hurt is the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
Less than 7% of the private sector is unionized these days.
Right.
And there's a lot of people that say a lot of the problems that we have in Washington and a lot of the financial troubles we've had in this country have been to a certain degree because of the non-unionizing of, like, the Rust Belt
right.
in the private sector.
So two sociologists, Bruce Western and Jake Rosenfeld, actually wrote a paper that said that the decline of organized labor unions from the 1970s on can account for as much as a third of the increase in income inequality in the U.S., which has been significant.
Sure.
And they can attribute a third of that increase just to the decline of labor.
Well, and I think it also coincided with the 1970s. Some say that big business really went hard at Washington for the not for the first time, but in a way that they'd never had before, and that changed the landscape of the distribution of wealth in this country.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting point, Chuck. Like, we were raised after that period.
Yeah.
But so that's just kind of like our, you know, we, The Secret of My Success or American Psycho, you know, all those great movies about the 80s or mm-hmm. set in the 80s. Like, that's just the way it was. Like, all these, like, you just go after money and, like, you spend that money on cocaine and pinstripe suits, you know, and Maseratis or whatever.
Yeah.
And so we were kind of raised with that sentiment. But there was a time prior to the 1970s, where it was labor who was running the charge. It was the unions, and they were fully in control.
Yeah.
And business figured out how to regroup and reassert itself, and that's the age that we're in now. So back to Eisenhower, though. When he was talking, he was kind of carrying on a tradition where the U.S. government figured out that, okay, there is a there is a balance of power that has to be struck between labor and business.
Yeah.
Because business is part of this economic engine. Labor helps fuel the economic engine, but they really kind of represent two different sectors
yeah.
of the U.S., not just economy, but the population. And we need to keep them happy. We need to strike this balance. So the federal government got involved starting in 1935 with the National Labor Relations Act. And they basically said, okay, we can't have strikes where you guys are shooting two-pound hinges at cops.
Yeah.
And we can't have strikes where cops are, like, murdering striking workers. Let's get to the heart of this matter and figure out how to strike a happy balance between what labor wants and what business wants and progress from there.
Yeah.
And it was a really smart thing to do.
Oh,
but
yeah.
they figured out that it was very much like Homer trying to keep Pinchy the Lobster alive with the goldfish
yeah.
in that freshwater tank, you know?
Yeah.
Adding salt, adding water. And it's been, that was kind of the mark of the 20th century in American economic history, was that adding the salt and adding the water over time through legislation.
Yeah. Well, and the NLRA was, like you said, the first one. And prior to that, companies didn't even have to recognize a union or negotiate with a union leader.
Right.
So this actually required by law that they, not necessarily that they give workers what they want, but they had to at least negotiate in good faith.
Right.
And sit down at the table with them.
Yeah, which effectively said it brought unions out of the dark and legalized them and
yeah.
gave them a legal voice and legal recourse.
That's right. And to enforce that, they soon passed the National Labor Relations Board to oversee what was going on with the NLRA. And the article points out here that they accomplished three things. It allowed workers to have elections. To, you know, elect their own union leaders,
mm-hmm.
Establish laws protecting employees from discrimination based on union activity. So, like, are you a union? Well, we don't want to hire you. That kind of thing.
Or even worse, like in the case of Ford Motor Company, led Ford's security wing led by Harry Bennett, a 2,000-man-strong goon squad
right.
that used to, like, beat up workers, beat up, like, organizers, beat up union reps. And do it, like, on camera. They really were kind of above the law in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But this was definitely that was targeted at guys like that.
For the goons.
Yeah.
And this kind of sneaks by, but an important thing to note here is the NLRA also protected collective bargaining, even if you're not in a union, and the ability to bargain for better conditions
yeah.
for all workers. So, I mean, it's the unions was one of the main things, but it protected everybody.
Yeah. But not everybody. There were a bunch of groups that were left out of this. Agricultural workers, domestic service workers, federal, state, and local government employees, which obviously
yeah.
went a different way.
Sure.
Railroad and airline employees. That one kind of became important, like we talked about in the air traffic control one. Under Reagan, when he fired all the air traffic controllers.
Yeah.
You know, who went on strike.
Yeah, and that's important. I guess, was that the Taft-Hartley that ensured? Yeah. Taft-Hartley Act came along in 1947, or the Labor Management Relations Act. And one of the important things it did was said, you know what, if there's any strike that's going to put the public health in danger, then we can issue an 80-day injunction that basically says you cannot strike.
Right.
And in the case of the... I guess, did that put the country in danger necessarily?
It put the country's economy in danger, I
yeah.
would say. But at the same time, Reagan didn't file an injunction through the Labor Relations Board. He
just
said,
fired
you're
everyone.
Fired. Okay. Get back to work. No, you're fired. Man, that guy.
I know. And what else did that? Oh, it outlawed secondary boycotts, the Taft-Hartley Labor Act, which was a big deal because the example they use here in this article is really good. Like, let's say you're a brewery and you're striking against your employer, you might have a boycott against the glass company that makes the beer bottles just to put the strong arm on the company from another direction.
Yeah.
And you can't do that.
It's called the squeeze.
You can't do the squeeze. It's not legal.
You can't as a union, but consumers
right.
frequently do that kind of
oh,
thing.
Oh, yeah, sure.
It's like trying to get, like, Rush Limbaugh off there. He boycotted, a lot of people boycotted his... advertisers
right
until they said, you know what, okay, we'll stop advertising with them, and then all of a sudden Rush Limbaugh has the double squeeze on him.
Right.
Same with the I can't remember, there was some special interest group, some PAC that was getting funding from like McDonald's, Wendy's, a bunch of people, and because of their alleged unfair and very much pro-business only practices, like all of these companies has kind of abandoned them recently.
Really?
Yeah. ALEC, A-L-E-C. I don't remember what it stands for.
Alec Baldwin?
No.
No.
No. No.
Okay. You sure?
Yes.
The Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act of 1959, Josh? Mm-hmm. What's that all about?
Well, this was during a time when the winds had really shifted toward not only the unions having the their labor business under their thumb, they also had their union members under their thumb.
Right.
The mob was involved. The democracy or the democratic basis of unions had eroded.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of shady stuff going on. This, what I thought was cool was rather than the federal government going, oh, well, then we need to reinvigorate the power given to business
yeah.
under these union laws. Instead, they went and invested more power in union members.
That's right.
Yeah. Like you couldn't use union dues anymore to promote one candidate over another. In a union for
yeah,
union reps.
The elections were really pretty heavily monitored from that point on.
Uh-huh.
Every single union member has to be notified by mail at least 15 days before the election.
Yep.
Like you can't sneak an election by them, which probably used to happen in the old days.
Yep. To increase transparency in the whole union thing, there was a lot of disclosure and reporting requirements that were added.
Yeah.
And not just for the unions, but for also like employers, consultants. They wanted to know where the money was going. And basically, they wanted to see how the mob was involved is a big one.
Right. Well, and speaking of money, I don't think we pointed out that a lot of times unions will have strike funds, and some of the money that you pay into it will actually pay you when you go on strike to keep you from going hungry.
Yeah. It's like Affleck.
You know that Gilbert Gottfried doesn't do that anymore, I don't think.
I know, and I wonder how ironic would it be if he had Aflac insurance and that it kicked in once Aflac fired him.
Interesting. I think he got fired because he wanted too much money.
No, he got fired for making Twitter jokes about the Japanese tsunami, like the
really?
Day of, yeah.
Oh, I thought it was a money issue.
Yeah, I'm worried about the sense of humor in this country in the direction it's going. Like there's stand-up comedians have almost always been allowed to they're exempted from a lot of
sure.
the standards that average Joes are held to, you know, like they're stand-up comedians. That's their job. Sometimes they make tasteless jokes and all that stuff.
But yeah. They'll go over the line and they'll just go, people go, ooh, and they'll go, what, too soon? And yeah, then that's
right.
It.
Exactly. And then people will be like, yes, it is.
Right.
But there seems to be open season on comedians.
Well, because of platforms that they've never had before, probably like Twitter.
I guess.
All of a sudden that's like your official statement instead
yeah.
of a joke you made.
Or, yeah. And the audience is much, much wider and much more, varied and diverse too. So
yeah, true.
Yeah,
I bet Gilbert Gottfried's so pissed off.
I would imagine so.
Because I mean, you got tell me, there's like not 10,000 people lining up, voice actors to go Aflac for a huge paycheck.
I think you just made a pretty good argument for yourself.
That wasn't as good as GG, but.
But I mean, and the problem is I realize what's at risk is you know cultural sensitivity, even individual sensitivity toward people who are going to be offended or hurt.
Yeah.
But there has to be a balance between that and, I mean, the other thing that's at risk is like our national sense of humor.
Yeah.
Which is really important.
Sure.
It's one of those things you could be like, well, that's just a stupid joke. No. Like our ability to take a joke is a very vital and important thing about keeping us from like all, you know, killing ourselves.
Yeah.
And one of the roles that stand-up comedians provide, or any kind of comedian provides, is to keep that healthy and vital and going.
Agreed. There's nothing more of a turnoff to me than when you see a humorless celebrity.
Oh, man.
Like when Ricky Gervais is doing his thing at the Golden Globes and you see, like, the people out there that just are offended by this. I'm like, come on, man.
Yeah, I don't know. I think
laugh
I can
at yourself.
I can see Ricky Gervais being, we'll make him the sacrificial lamb. Leave Gilbert Gottfried alone, you know?
Man, that was a sidebar.
Yes, it was.
Are we talking about labor unions?
I don't remember.
Labor unions today, Josh, you mentioned the AFL-CIO. A lot of people might not know that that is actually a collection. It's a labor federation made up of 54 member unions, 10 million strong.
That's a lot of people.
Change to Win is sort of a new one. 2005 it was formed, but it is an also a labor federation encompassing 7 unions and 6 million workers. Big time.
Yeah, the AFL was founded by Samuel Gompers, who I mentioned earlier.
That's right.
And he got some cigar makers and some other industrial laborers together to form that. And then that was in the late 19th century.
Yeah.
And I can't remember exactly when, but maybe in the 40s or the 50s, he got together with the CIO to form the AFL-CIO.
Because he loves cigars.
UAW is a huge one.
Auto workers?
Yeah, they have something like 1.4 million members. The Teamsters has 1.4 million members. And they're the ones who are probably the most well-known by the average Joe, thanks to one Jimmy Hoffa.
Yeah. Do you know his story?
A little bit here or there. The whole mob involvement, I think, with the with any union was they realized that there's a bunch of guys who are sitting on enormous piles of money, and let's see how much of that we can steal or get our hands on or use to build ourselves casinos.
Right.
And Jimmy Hoffa was in with these guys, and he just went missing, right, in 1975?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's any secret what happened to him, but they definitely don't know exactly what happened. And
I thought
exactly
the whole point was it was a secret what happened to him.
Well, he was snuffed out.
Oh.
I don't think he, just had a heart attack while hiking in the wilderness and his body decomposed naturally.
Well, he was supposedly going, he was last seen waiting on two mafia associates.
Yeah.
It's kind of a dead giveaway, too.
Yeah.
But his son, James P. Hoffa, has really kind of brought the family name back tremendously.
Yeah, he's the head of the Teamsters today, right?
Yes, he is. He's the president of the Teamsters Union and is doing a lot of work toward re-legitimizing unions again in this country, which is pretty cool.
Well, anyone who's ever been on a film set and has seen a 275-pound man eating a donut sitting in his truck, you can say, I've met a Teamster, and they do great work.
And they're basically, I can't remember the number, but they're if you're an industrial worker, you're basically eligible to be a Teamster.
Yeah.
And in just about any kind of industry.
I'm going to get hate mail for that.
Oh, you'll be fine. There's like two guys that you described who listen to this podcast, so you get two pieces of hate mail.
If I was a Teamster, I would do nothing but listen to this podcast because you're just sitting around all day.
Remember?
That's not true. Teamsters do great work, but on film sets, it's sort of the old joke is that like they'll park the truck and then they sit in it until they leave in the truck.
You know, there was another Simpsons reference just came up with the one where that film for Radioactive Man comes to town.
Yeah.
And Homer tries to see who can out-lazy the Teamsters.
Good stuff.
That is just a stereotype, although.
Yeah, but stereotypes are there for a reason, right?
It's not funny.
It's not funny.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes. That it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, We have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
What else?
I don't have anything else. You got anything else?
No, I guess I think we covered pretty much everything.
Yeah, it's a nice broad overview. People can, and like you said early on, man, you hit it on the head, my friend.
Thank you.
Whether or not you are pro-union or anti-union largely depends on your family's background.
Yeah.
It's a very tried and true thing through families, through generations that, you know, people feel very strongly about it that are involved in unions. Or like my parents were in the teachers union.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
You're a union kid, huh?
Yeah, but that wasn't like factory stuff. Like I never heard them.
Right.
Besides complaining about not making enough money, which every teacher should complain about.
Sure. And if you don't have any kind of passionate feelings about it whatsoever, I would advise you to look into it.
Yeah.
And if you do have passionate feelings about it, I think a great exercise would be to explore how the other side sees it. See if it changes your mind one way or the other.
Look at you.
You can do that by reading this fascinating article that we just based this podcast on, how unions work. You can type that in the search bar at howstuffworks.com. You can also go into WAPO. There was a pretty cool editorial.
That's the Washington Post, by the way.
That's right. The Wisconsin union fight isn't about benefits. It's about labor's influence, from March 6, 2011.
That's a good article.
That was a good article, too. And I already said search bar, which means it's time for listener mail.
You know, our buddy Joe Garden was, he's a sconny.
Oh,
he was really upset last year.
You can tell. You can see right through his skin. He's so pale. He's translucent.
Vote Joe Garden.
Yeah.
Big craft work guy.
Oh, yeah. Did he get tickets?
No, he did it. He promoted his own craft work. I believe it was a craft work covers show.
Oh, cool.
And he got different bands to come and play craft work. And it was a big deal for Joe. It was awesome. He wore his like white suit and introduced everyone.
That is sweet. When was that?
Very recently.
Did you see footage of it, or were you there?
No, he was just, he wouldn't shut up about it on Facebook.
Oh,
and
gosh.
Even admitted, like, guys, I know you're tired of hearing about craft work.
That is significant for Joe.
Yes.
Yeah. There's also, I guess, kind of in with the music sampling episode, there's, I think, a DJ Food or a DJ Shadow. I think DJ Food. Craft work cover mix.
Yeah.
There's like maybe three volumes of it, and it's like just mixing together all these people who like sampled Kraftwerk for their songs.
Yeah, they just did a big thing at some museum, I think.
At MoMA.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God. Yumi and I tried very hard to get those tickets. Did you try?
No, dude.
Dude, it was such
I'm not
a
into it.
Cluster.
I'm not into Kraftwerk, and this solidifies it when I saw the reviews of it, and it said they did like a 21 minute of Autobahn, and I was just like, somebody put a gun to my head.
Yeah. Oh, you're just supposed to zone out and forget where you are for a little bit and see where it takes you.
I'm not a Kraftwerk guy, but I know people are. People love
No,
them.
I'm not a Kraftwerk guy either. Like, but I will say that like that would have been just a momentous thing to see.
Momentous?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Like the Tupac hologram. I'm sure seeing that at Coachella was just amazing.
Yeah, and a bit way more amazing for some people than others even.
Sure.
All right. So should I read a listener mail?
I guess.
I'm going to call this a good cause. We like to promote these. And attach it to our labor union episode, how appropriate. Big, big fan, guys. I was just down at South by Southwest, where I caught your variety show and shook your surprisingly supple hands. I also
You've never done a lick of work.
I know. I also sat on a panel called Harnessing the Power of the Benevolent Internet, something you guys seem pretty skilled at yourselves, which is why I thought You might be game to help students across the country learn all sorts of stuff they should know. In many cases, it's stuff they need to know. I work for a nonprofit website called DonorsChoose.org, where anyone with a dollar can give support to classrooms in need. Teachers from all 50 states post requests for resources they feel their students need, and kind folks from all over the world help bring those lessons to life.
Oh, that's cool.
Sounds almost sort of like a Kiva for teachers.
Right. I need 50 tickets to Kraftwerk at the moment.
Since our founding in 2000, we've delivered over $110 million of resources directly to public school classrooms, supporting more than 6 million students. And if you or my fellow listeners would like to help, Okay.
We have listeners. That listener has fellow listeners.
Okay. Check out the page I set up. He set up a page with our name, and I was like, that's cool, you can do that, but we're not like, we can't officially, like, sign on, because then it has to go through corporate and all that stuff.
But, oh, I already signed us on officially.
Oh, you did?
I made t-shirts and everything.
No, you didn't. So you can go to donorschoose.org/stuffkidsshouldknow, and let me know if you have any questions. And this is from Zach. And he said, by the way, we recently hired a system admin a couple of months back. It drove me crazy for a few weeks. Then I realized he sounds exactly like Josh.
Weird.
And he said, I've enjoyed working with you, Josh.
Who is the other voice double for me? There's another person.
There was some dude. Well, there's a writer that writes about running.
He wrote one thing about running
once.
It's
Josh Clark.
And I've been asked 500 times if it was me. What's ironic is now I actually run.
You should write your own article.
Yeah.
I can't remember. There was some other voice person that did, like, bike videos or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, okay. Who is that?
That was Zach.
Thanks, Zach.
DonorsChoose.org/kids/stuffkidsshouldknow.
That's great. DonorsChoose.org/stuffkidsshouldknow.
Indeed.
Nice. If you have a great charitable organization you want us to let everybody know about, again, we're always happy to do that. And if I sound like somebody, let me know, because it's driving me crazy who it is. I've heard from like a bunch of people, oh, you sound just like this or whatever. I don't remember.
Or I want to hear from people who have actively been on a worker strike. Or if you have been a scab, as they call them.
Oh, yeah.
And been a strike buster.
Or
I want to hear about that too.
If you've ever been beaten up by the cops, we want to hear about that too.
Yes.
And anarchists. Any anarchists out there. We're always interested in hearing from anarchists, I guess.
I got shook down by the cops in Athens one night.
You get beat up, there's a difference.
No, but they like threw me against the wall and like were kicking my legs out from under me and
it was delicious.
Weird. And then they just left.
Are you sure there were cops and not just some fraternity boys dressed up as cops?
Athens police in a car. Me and my three friends. I don't know what they thought we were doing, but they got out of there really quick. I'll say that.
They must have thought you were somebody else.
Yeah, Kevin Smith.
Or the reality of their situation hit them and they realized that what they were doing was wrong.
Maybe.
You can communicate with Chuck and I electronically via Twitter at SYSKpodcast. That's our handle. Facebook.com/stuffyoushouldknow, or you can send us an email to stuffpodcast@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.